The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by One More. Treat your ears. One More's mission is to bring innovation, design, and quality to all music lovers, young or old, frugal or spendy. Offering an incredible collection of earbuds at all tiers of the market, cabled or Bluetooth, neckband or true wireless. Fantastic sound quality, top-tier tuning, excellent noise reduction. I've personally been a fan for a couple years now. Right now, my headphone of choice is the Dual Driver ANC Pro neckband. Great battery life, punchy dynamic sound, and crazy good noise reduction in a very convenient just drop your earbud neckband design. Or you can get those same features and completely cut the cords with the Dual Driver ANC True Wireless, one of the absolute best options in the completely cable-free space. Or maybe you want to fill a decently large room with a pair of One More portable Bluetooth speakers. There's a whole collection of great audio options for you to shop at affordable prices. And for listeners of this podcast, I can also do you one better. If you shop at onemore.com, use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY10 at checkout. Once again, SOMEGADGETGUY10 with no spaces. You'll save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. You'd spend over $80 less on One More's Dual Driver ANC True Wireless compared to that other brand's Pro earbuds. You know who I'm talking about. One More brings style, premium audio quality, and cool tech features to the table at prices that won't hurt the wallet. You can check out these multiple award-winning audio solutions at onemore.com. And remember to use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY10 at checkout to save some scratch. Now, let's get on with the show. All right. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another Monday Morning Tech Chat show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this horribly named podcast series. And NVIDIA Broadcast has been real twitchy lately. So, like, let's see if we can get the camera to just kind of keep me centered. We were playing with it on Best of Our Week, the show with TK on Thursday, and it was getting real wiggy. Oh, one second, I'm going to punch in just a little bit closer, too. You get a little bit more in my face. And see, now, see, did it. Okay, I'm kind of centered in the frame, so let's see. Let's see what it does. But of course, for SGGQA, the important part of this horrible acronym of a podcast name is the Q&A, and that couldn't be more true. This week, I'm starting off really slow. Last week was a marathon of wind sprints, and culminating in trying to try and celebrate a family holiday with a six-year-old and give her something special. It was pretty intense. We went from Lex's sixth birthday all the way through to Halloween. And that's like 7 days of just party planning and activities planning in the middle of Techtober. And it beat me up pretty royal. And I gotta say, the thing that we always kind of concern ourselves with is amazing things are happening and some really amazing moments are happening. And there's that part of my brain that's getting ever more anxious about losing some of these memories or not preserving some of these moments. And, for all of the amazing things that have happened over the last 2 weeks, I mean, like, I want to have a moment, I want to take a minute and reflect and like, this cool stuff happened. And I kind of want to hold on to that stuff a little bit tighter. And I'm shooting more photos and videos than ever before. And like my wife and I are genuinely like, we'll get to the end of the night, we'll put Lex to bed. And then we're like, hey, like, we'll just go down a deep dive. And like, hey, 2 years ago, do you remember when we were doing this? And you're like, no, but there's our daughter, two spooning an ice cream sundae. You know, rah, 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 rah. And like how fragile that is. And It's a lot. So, good morning, everybody. I didn't mean to start off so deep. But we're gonna have a very casual pajama podcast chat this week, just to kind of make up for the fact that, like I said, I've been burning the candle at both ends. I do not have like my news block and my podcast block and a subreddit block. I don't have notes. I don't have anything. I'm here to answer some questions. We've got four of the craziest new phones sitting right on my table in front of me: the Duo 2, the X70 Pro Plus, the Sony Xperia Pro I, the Pixel 6 Pro. These phones are starting to make it out into consumers' hands, which means they're completely irrelevant to reviewers now. Now that all the filthy proles can get their hands on these phones, now Techtober's so boring and we're over it. This has been the best Techtober I've had in years. I have not had more fun messing around with bleeding edge consumer tech than I have had over this last month. I need to find like a new pace just for getting videos and content out there, because man, this month rocked my socks. But every time I turned around, there was something like stressful and something that made me anxious. And then at the end of that was like, oh, but this is cool. So I'm kind of not in the vibe. I've seen a number of tweets from some of my contemporaries like, "Oh, I'm so glad the stupid month is over now." And you're like, that's kind of sad. Why be in this if you're not going to get lit up about some genuinely exciting tech? I know Samsung did not have a strong month for Techtober, and that means you had to put more effort into videos that aren't going to pay off as well because of YouTube metrics and algorithms and stuff. But just dig the tech. I mean, if you're not digging the tech, what are we doing? What are we doing in the tech? Like, go be a lifestyle channel or something. That's fine. Maybe you'll probably be happier. Because right now, I'm still going full steam on all of these phones. I'm still running the Vivo through its paces, and that was like 3 weeks ago. Who would even have anything to say about a phone that's like 3 weeks old? So, I'm having a great time with this, and I hope everybody else has had past tense, because we're out of Techtober now. I hope everyone had a lovely Techtober, and I've got to take care of that and that. All right. Happy day after Halloween. I hope everyone survived the trick-or-treating. We're all in sort of post-long walk, sugar buzz, coma. Lex had a phenomenal night. It was really tough last year trying to explain to a then just turned 5-year-old who had a very family, modest quarantine birthday party, like why we weren't going to be doing any trick-or-treating. It's not as special when you buy just a bag of candy and you eat it at home. She didn't get to show off her costume to anybody. It was really tough. And this year, Marie and I are still probably a bit more aggressive in managing our own health issues than a lot of folks out there. We're very anxious and concerned about the long-term effects if one of us gets COVID, if Lex gets COVID. We have a bunch of genetic predispositions to autoimmune conditions, and like if we can avoid getting a virus that messes with your immune system, we're going to work as hard as we can to avoid that. But this year we really put it together. Lex has been amazing, keeping her mask on, interacting with other people, but without like, getting too close or touching people like little kids kind of are wont to do. And so she decided she wanted to be Harry Potter. She did not want to be Hermione. She wanted to be Harry. So we're slicking back her hair to, because she's got kind of longer hair. So she inadvertently looked just a bit more like Malfoy than Harry. But she had the glasses on. We drew the little scar, and she's running around in her Gryffindor robes, and she's got her wand.
and we took her out to one of the more sort of family neighborhoods, kind of nearby our home, and we racked up 15,000 steps as she went running from house to house and yelling trick-or-treat at the top of her lungs, and it was kind of amazing. So I hope people, whether or not you went out trick-or-treating, whether or not you're with, you know, small children or anything like that, you know, if you know, you're a part of a family dynamic or if you just kicked it solo, I hope everyone got to do something special. For my brother and his girlfriend, it was like watching crazy old scary movies, you know, like that's exactly what they needed to do. For my sister and her husband, it was like a real chill night in, you know, ordering some silly takeout and sort of drinking the night away. You know, my mom and dad, my dad's on this kick for like watching the Halloween films, and I don't know how far he made it because the Halloween films get real weird after Halloween 3. So I just hope that everybody out there had something that was for them. Just, I know I get all weird and sentimental about holidays, and they're not really any more special than any other day of the week, but there are moments to kind of, you know, reflect, or moments to celebrate, or moments to do just something silly and fun for yourself, and those moments are precious few and far between these days. So, why don't we... Sorry, I said something about, you know, tech and not having, so Kappa Cash bringing up, if it's not Apple or Samsung, it's not tech. You know, I gotta say, there's that feeling in the air. We've been talking about this on the podcast, and as we want to chat Pixel 6, there was some of that concern, right? I feel like the tech community, especially the tech review community, after losing a major player like LG, that, you know, LG was the third place in sales in North America. So you could always make them the loser, but they had a substantial enough fan base that the SEO worked really well, right? Last quarter, LG was still like 7% of smartphone sales in North America. There is still a significant population of people that are buying LG phones. And if they're not the third place, then they're pretty close to being the fourth place, and they didn't make any phones this year. That was the momentum that we lost when we lost LG as a smartphone player. So tech reviewers lost their favorite whipping boy. You could always put LG up, count on some contingent of LG fans getting upset about that tone in your commentary, but then you could ally Samsung and Apple fans against that distant third place. Who would even want to buy that? So now reviewers have lost that. And so it seems to me that literally every other brand that is not Samsung or Apple is the implied loser. I've been sitting in on Twitter spaces. I've been hanging out in Discords. I've been lurking on Twitch streams, on YouTube videos. And there's like a core contingent of reviewers that I prefer their content because they show their work. They're relatively consistent in how they test. I think they do a good job of breaking down their philosophy of how they produce reviews. And those people, you know, there are some pros and there are some cons, but ultimately you arrive at this is what the phone is and this is what it can do and this is what you might like and this is what you might be concerned by. And outside of that core contingent, it's like, we're watching the tech community turn on the Pixel. We hyped them up. We needed to build them up. We needed to have that important third place SEO challenger. But the Pixel phones are still an other brand. And by that, I mean you've got Samsung and Apple in North America now occupying, if not close to, probably over 80% of smartphone sales. And the other 20% are broken down into single-digit market share. I mean, that's not good. That is an awful place to be for good, consistent competition. So it's a bunch of like, well, I don't even know what they're trying to do. Who is this phone even for? You know, like, you know a reviewer has lost it, and all they're doing is pimping Samsung and Apple if they ask a bunch of open-ended questions, but they can't answer them. it's not that difficult to try and break down a phone like the Duo 2. But who could this be for? How do hands even work? And if you use it, you can get a pretty clear sense of who might like it and the majority of people who probably won't. And that's fair. But that doesn't mean the phone is a winner or a loser just because it's not going to convince an iPhone SE owner to put down their iPhone SE and go and spend four times more on a Duo 2. Like, that's not how any of this works. So I'm feeling like, especially for Pixel 6, I'm feeling like the commentary on Pixel 6 is starting to flip. There was a lot of that, oh, I'm so concerned about embargoes. Not when Apple or Samsung do embargoes, but I'm so concerned about Google doing an embargo. And I loved it because it was all of these creators and all of these tech YouTubers who were so like, I make reviews, telling it how it is, the tough talk, the tough criticisms for the average consumers, but I can't have my video go out with all of the smaller channels. Suddenly, when we hit the second embargo date, we had a whole list of creators who were like, you know what? Now, even though I've had the phone longer than any other channel, now I firmly believe that you can't review a phone like the Pixel in this short of an embargo window. I didn't have that issue with the Duo 2, and I never have that issue with the Samsung or Apple when I get exclusive access to those phones above all of these smaller channels. But all of these Team Pixel channels, you just can't trust their reviews because they haven't had the phone as long as we have. And we're telling you, don't, you know, wait for our reviews because we're really going to take the time to review it right. Now we care about the length of time a creator has with the phone. I mean, it's just the people who profit the most from this type of, you know, early access, special access, now suddenly so concerned. So, Russ, we can definitely talk about Xperia Pro I. From Dustadore, I feel like Marie and I, we might be overreacting in a lot of situations, but I'm kind of anxious about underreacting. You know, like it's tough stuff. Sorry, Dustadore writes, I feel you on keeping it safe and being cautious, especially some folks already acting pre-COVID normal. We were walking by Halloween family homes. And there were some so many creative and fun solutions to Halloween. We went to this one house, and they had this big display, full-size candy bars, right? And they had all of the full sizes in this display. And this woman kind of dressed in just sort of a simple witch costume calls out to Lex. Lex has to yell trick-or-treat first, and then she calls out to Lex, okay, tell me which one you want. And Lex is looking, and she goes, Twix. And she has this giant, goofy, like, zombie hand. She puts the Twix, and she's wearing gloves, and she's wearing a mask in her witch's costume. She puts the Twix in the zombie hand, and she reaches it over the display. Happy Halloween! And it's like, oh my god, that is so adorable, and so funny, and was such like a, you know, I'm not gonna act like your kid is filthy, but kids are kind of filthy. It just like it was so sweet, and like so many different families on that block just coming up with different ways, like, hey, we can have a dance party for your trick, and you can kind of like show off some moves and playing some music, and then the candy's like in a bowl, but they're still like playing with the kids as they come up to the homes. So many like fun like jump scary little animatronic things. I mean, this neighborhood that we just moved to really rose to the occasion of doing fun things in a time of global pandemic. I was blown away by the creativity. It was just incredible. So Russ, wow, LG third in North America, did not know that. Who would take the third place now? So my hypothesis is Google will eventually build up third place numbers. We still have the momentum of the Pixel A series. LG put out some promo materials saying, hey, for all of our LG smartphone fans, maybe consider getting a Pixel 5a. And because we've seen that you've used LG phones in the past, here's $50 off. And you can buy it through this kind of an outlet. I really feel like Google has a strong potential to eat up some of those lost sales. I know V-Series and Velvet weren't the top sellers in the LG space. Like K-Series and Stylo like sold like crazy, and that's kind of what bumped up LG's numbers. But a not insignificant number of people were rocking V60s and Velvets. So if you can switch a Velvet owner over to a Pixel 6, then you've got a great opportunity to kind of fill that in. I think a lot of LG smartphone users are going to end up on Samsung just for something that's a little more South Korean familiar, but it's a huge opportunity. Streamy boys, Xiaomi is not in North America at all. There is a tiny diehard ride or die Xiaomi community, people who import the phones, but they are not they are becoming the world's top smartphone brand and completely ignoring North America. If you want to see kind of how irrelevant North America is to so many companies, you can watch the rise of Xiaomi. Every other company on the planet that does not want to have to mess with carrier deals, North America is not an easy market to crack and is obnoxiously difficult to find some market share. Oh, come on, pull up the comment. There it is. I've never seen a phone scrutinized as much in recent memory as the Pixel 6, at least on social media anyway. It seemed to start with the 5A. My favorite thing is, like, I was sitting in a Twitter space and like, some pretty, you know, good mid-high-level tech reviewers, I mean, in terms of, like, audience and stuff, just, like, picking it apart. And you're like, oh, but the functionality is all gone now. This one widget doesn't do the same thing that it used to do when you tap it. Or my favorite is when they're complaining, like, okay, so this new Material U design, or Material design aesthetic, I should probably, here, let me swipe that away. Okay, I mean, like, look at these large toggle buttons. I mean, that's so much wasted space. And used to have like twice as many, and this is what stock Android is now. And I feel like that's one that I need everyone to kind of push back on, right? Pixels aren't stock Android. If you want stock Android, you should pick up a Sony. So here, I'm going to pick up a Sony, and this is as close to like stock open source Android as you can get. There is very minimal UI customization happening on an Xperia. But let's see what happens in stock Android when I swipe down. Okay, so there are six icons at the top of my quick settings, and I'm going to swipe down again. There are still only six icons. But wait a minute. We're so concerned about UI control density, right? We're so worried about average consumers maximizing every pixel of real estate on their phones, right? Oh my gosh, what's happening? Stock Android only has six, but then I pick up a Pixel, and when I swipe down on that notification, I have eight toggles. I need techies to bring this energy, be this critical. Because right now we've got techies making conclusive statements about Pixel 6 the week consumers are starting to get their Pixel 6, right? Minimal software polish, minimal updates. There's so much that needs to be addressed. But I need tech reviewers to bring this energy to every iPhone review. You got to come up with your conclusion and fail to figure out who a phone is for on week one, day one of you getting the phone, the next iPhone, day one of you getting the next Galaxy S,
smartphone. Samsung is going to One UI 4. What? But if One UI 3 was so good, why do they need to update it? Huh? Who is this phone even for now, Samsung? I need to hear that. If you're going to wig out this hard on material design, material you, and you're going to wig out this hard on one of the most ambitious projects that Google has ever released, because Google's in the unenviable task. They have to come up with Android 12. They're coming up with their own kind of customizations for the UI on top of Android 12. They're launching their own phone with their own SoC, and they're doing this all in 1 year. So, yes, let's not give Google a pass, but also let's put these things in perspective. And I feel there's an implied goalpost moving for Samsung and Apple. Samsung phones always launch with significant issues. iPhones always launch with significant issues. But you know what? Samsung and Apple, they're going to fix them. We always know that Samsung and Apple, they get in there and they fix those problems. Even though I have a Galaxy S10, an S10e in front of me, that is still requiring numerous bug fixes in consistent One UI updates. So let's keep these things in perspective, because I kind of feel like Google has earned a little bit of consideration for being the best in Android land at improving performance over time. My Pixel 4 XL is faster and more powerful today than it was at launch. And this is going into Android 12. My Pixel 5 got significant improvements to performance and is one of the only phones with that mid-ranger processor that can shoot 4K 60 frame per second video. Only Google and LG even tried. Any other phone rocking that 760, like, to my memory, if there's another one out there, please let me know. But I don't believe there are many other phones rocking 765s outside the Wing, not the Velvet, but the Wing, the Pixel 5 and the 5A that can shoot 4K 60. This new 4K 60 frame per second video that we all care about for those average consumers, right? But Pixel 5, over three software updates, found like 15% more GPU performance and a nice little nudge up for CPU performance. My Galaxy S10e is still a snappy performer. It did not get faster. It did not get more powerful over successive Samsung updates. Them's the breaks. If I run my benchmarks on the newest build of One UI, which I am right now, I'm getting the same performance scores that I got near launch two operating systems ago. So Samsung is keeping you pigeonholed. iPhones keep you pigeonholed. You get the newest, most powerfulest SoC, but that doesn't mean you get access to that power. And here, we've got a pretty good track record of Google pushing the limits on what they can do with the hardware they've been given. And now we've got to see if they can do the same thing with Tensor. But that earns them a little consideration. So if we're going to go into every Samsung and Apple conversation with the assumption that they're going to do software, they do the good software, we need to do the same for Google. They've earned that roadmap. They've earned that consideration. Going back to like the Pixel 3a running real snappy on Android 12, Android 12 has some bugs. Every new operating system does. You want to talk about bugs, we can talk about the bug on iOS 15 that allows Safari browser exploits to do remote jailbreaks. If you haven't updated your iPhone, jump on that, because the company that makes the most noise about security and privacy has one of the biggest gaping holes in their security right now. Fix that and make sure your family and friends know about it. That's not complaining about iPhones just to hate on iPhones. That's legit. My aunt, my uncle, my grandmother, serious issues if they click on some bad links. We got to do better in these kinds of conversations. So, I'm way behind on the chat. Sorry, I went off on that, didn't I? Ah.
Yeah, people are bringing up Flossy Carter. Flossy Carter, what was his? How long was his video? It was like an hour and a half. I felt exhausted just getting to the end of my edit on a 20-minute Duo 2 video. Unless I can just go, you know, just top camera down, hands on a gadget, I don't think that would perform well for my channel. But unless I can do that and I don't have to edit, there's no way I can make videos that long. I'm going to finish up camera reviews. Like the Vivo camera review is over 40 minutes. And man, that rocked me hard. And Tiger Kim, this is a part of the problem. Tiger Kim writes, I never understand the reviews that are strictly a comparison of the iPhone and such. It's because you need to tell the largest audiences that they bought the right gadget. I believe in a style of tech conversation where it's okay to get excited about products you won't own. If you're a Fold fan, you need to be critically excited about what Microsoft is pulling off in this space. If you're an iPhone fan and you care about some of these more advanced camera features, you need to be looking at both Pixel and Sony, because those are some of the newer camera features that should hopefully make their way into future iPhones. If you're into tech, if your loyalty is to cool tech, then you're so much more inclined to find those things that are genuinely exciting about each individual phone. And that helps you say, hey, you know what? If you really use your phone like a communication device, there's a good reason why, even with some of the little bugs and sticky bits in Android 12 today, a Pixel 6 is going to rock your socks. When you get into call waiting, when you get into the more organic speech to text. Again, like, I love this, like, well, I mean, Google, they should just give all of these features to every Android phone. I love the hearing, like, I was in this Twitter space, and this sort of larger name in the tech community going off about, it's about software. You know, the Pixel 6 software, it's not ready. Why would they release a phone that's not 100% perfectly polished and it's just not ready? And Google, they were hyping their phone so much. And then to release it in this state, I mean, that's just, you know, I can't even imagine who this phone is for. And someone brings up, like, well, there are all these really cool things that you can do with Pixel software. And he brings up the speech to text, and he brings up, and then you can watch this other techie instantly flip. Oh, I mean, yeah, I mean, there are some gimmicks, I suppose. There's some fun gimmicks on a Pixel. But, I don't understand why Google is making those specific to the Pixel. They could just give those to everybody. I looked up a random iOS photo editing app that also has a feature similar to Magic Eraser. In fact, I think it's even better than Magic Eraser. And you're like, cool. And that photo editing app cost money. So here you are talking about, you know, it's about good software, but then you're also doing that techie moving the goalposts where good software should be free and has no cost and has nothing associated with it. So just, you know, all of these amazing features that people might value on a Pixel, well, that's not good enough. The fact that Google is making their own SoC to improve that software engineering, no, 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 no. Google should just give Samsung all of those unique features. You know, why not? Now, we're not going to get upset about Samsung having their own specific software features. We're not going to get upset about Samsung creating a lock-in where a Galaxy Watch isn't fully functional unless you pair it with a Samsung phone. No, 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 that's okay. No, that's all right because it's Samsung. But Google keeping better speech-to-text features and commands locked to a Pixel that has custom AI cores built specifically for that kind of software interaction? No, they need to give every Android every feature for free. And then conflating that with stock Android. Because it's not stock Android. I mean, all of these advanced Google Assistant, speech to text, new map features, translation features, material design, all of these are Pixel features. And increasingly,
will be Pixel features as Google invests in their own hardware to support those Pixel features. So it's not a good look. It's not a good look at all. Sorry, I am so far behind on the chat. I just caught everybody talking about the Twix. So unfortunately, she ended up with two left-handed Twix. So I don't know how she's going to eat them because she's right-handed. Kyle Ruggles asks, what camera is Juan using? The blur is impressive, except if it takes the phone away from his face. I'm using my Panasonic. This is the G9, but I'm using it with NVIDIA Broadcast. So it's doing ever so slightly a light background blur in software. So I can make it silly obvious. But Kyle, I feel like you would understand my pain looking at this frame right now. Because boy howdy do I not think this looks good. That was too many negatives. Boy howdy do I think this looks bad. But if I set it to its absolute lowest, I think this looks real good for a live stream.
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r glowing rectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
From Aditya Anil. Okay, listen, I do not like the big toggles. That's not for me. That's not an objective bad. It's a subjective gripe. Also, yeah, Sony UI is stalker than the Pixel UI. I feel like a whole chunk of this conversation, either these techies are really that ignorant of how other phones work, or this is a very selective outrage, in a disingenuous kind of way to make sure that they can kind of guide a conversation in a specific direction. I don't know. I mean, again, the end game is ultimately like you kind of say the things that are reassuring to certain people and that gets you more views and stuff. But I don't know. Dave Burns, I love this. UI density is so flipping dumb. I would love to have them talk with a UX designer. I'm not that bothered by the large toggles. You know, the funny thing is I still miss... was it Android 10 that the Pixel 4 launched with, when I would go to my settings, because I genuinely do turn my font and my UI settings down to their smallest. I miss on the Pixel 4 that you would have your entire list of settings on the screen without having to swipe. I miss that. I don't like having a phone this large and I still need to kind of scroll up. I wish I could condense all of this, even though I'm at the smallest font size. Is that ruining my use of the Pixel? I'm having a hard time kind of gathering, like, what is it that I'm genuinely supposed to be bothered by, and who is that a criticism for? Because on the one hand, if we're talking about the average consumers, I don't think they're going to care. And I don't mean that to sound flip or dismissive, because I know some people genuinely do care about software design, UX design. But if UI organization were so important, and this is something that would make a purchasing decision for an average consumer, which I hate having to vomit that out of my face for this. If that were true, And if all of these tiny little millimeters of design, boring design, all of these criticisms were true, iPhones would sell disastrously poorly. We're so worried about wasted space and inefficient gestures on a Pixel. Well, you have two horrifically conflicting UI designs on the iPhone. You have pages of apps that are just tacked on to the end of an endless list of panels on the order of which you install them. So that's one UI organization method that immediately crashes into App Library, which is not a good app drawer. It is an awkwardly auto-based folder collection of apps that you don't get to decide what apps go in what folders. So it's like you have to do 100% of the organizing and customizing on a phone that does not organize app icons and widgets very well. It fights you on every single panel that you want to organize things on. Or you have to go 100% full auto, and you can have both at the same time. That is bad UI design. That is terrible. And then you combine that. Well, I mean, you only have the four quick toggles when you swipe down from your settings. But you have a split notification shade on the iPhone. So if you swipe from one corner, you get quick settings and toggles, and it doesn't maximize the space of that, you know, dumping as many tiny little controls as you possibly can. There's a lot of space in between those toggles and settings. Or you swipe from the other side and you get your notifications. And let's not forget that iOS notifications are still kind of garbage, especially compared to what we're doing with stacked notifications and especially notification replies on Android 12. I feel like Google is still two generations ahead on maximizing the efficiency of interactions with notifications every single time you use your phone, where the iPhone is not that at all. So if we were so concerned about moving from Android 11 to Android 12, then we should be coming at the iPhone with that same kind of energy. And in fact, I think we should be holding the iPhone to a much higher standard, because Apple is going to sell way more iPhones. So way more people are going to be affected by this bad design. But we're not doing that. We're being very selective about how this is such an awful transition on the Pixel. I mean, like, again, I feel like this is a very clear example of how you can speak for this audience of average consumers, and you can be so concerned about what they're going to encounter, and then at the same time completely ignore even worse examples of that, because those phones are already sales popular. And if your argument is someone who owns an iPhone might pick up a Pixel and on their first day of use they're not going to like it, I don't think anyone's going to disagree. I think everyone would agree if you were to switch between an iPhone and a Pixel, there would be a steep learning curve and a difficult transition. But beyond that, what are we trying to accomplish? Because I feel that's, you know, I think y'all feel me on that. Slick Rick Moranis, it's not wasted space to me. It's proper separation is to not hit the wrong thing on a busy day. I kind of like that there's like a scrolling text kind of vibe so that more information can be included in the bubble. It needs refinement. I mean, that's fair. It needs to be refined. If we're going to use these big fat toggles for better information delivery, Google needs to tweak this a little. But I don't think it's a deal breaker yet. I have a greater density of information on my screen than stock Android, and I feel it will be clearer for many more people out there who would pull the notification shade on a Samsung and just see row after row after row after row of all these tiny little icons. I think this will be more informative, and it will succeed in the mission that Google is coming out and saying, this is an operability issue for many smartphone consumers. It doesn't take much away from us power users. I don't love it, but I don't hate it. And I feel like right now we're all trying to act like this is polarizing. I'm going to hand this phone to my grandmother, and what is she going to say? And you're like, if you tell her it's garbage, she'll be like, oh, okay, yeah, that's garbage, mijo. You know, like, if you hand it to her and just let her use it, she's probably going to go, oh, okay, it's different. Sure. No, but this is bad. It's different, and different is bad. Oh, okay, yeah, different is bad. So far, my wife and my dad. My dad has a Pixel 4a. My wife has a 4a 5G. I got to watch them install Android 12, and they both kind of shrugged. And these are two of the least techie smartphone users in my family. Okay, it's different. That happens on my phones whenever I install updates. Things seem to get different. Is it still running my apps? Sure. Okay. I had to figure out where a couple different buttons are. And then they got on with their lives. And I feel like that's Google's mission, is get on with your life. It's not necessarily the perfect phone for me in terms of like power user features. And I don't think that's going to matter. I feel like the sales are going to be strong because they're actually excited to talk about this phone. They're putting some effort behind marketing, and they're going to show a reasonably good track record of updating and supporting their devices, as they always have. Let's see. See, Russ, this is totally fair. And again, it's also a part of familiarity. Russ writes, a little con for me for Pixel phones, their button placement is kind of off in my opinion, but that's just a gripe. I'm actually kind of with you. The way that they've done, we want to get nitpicky here. The way that they've done these big panels, these large buttons, because of text being sort of right justified, it makes it feel like there should be another row of buttons. I don't know how to express this with any kind of learned UI designer aesthetic part of this conversation, but it just feels like there should be content to the left of this, and that there's kind of an open area by the volumes, not the volumes, the backlight slider, that is also kind of indicating that something else should happen. I'm so programmed by like old school ripoffs of Zune UI design that to me, I'm looking at this thinking like there's a part of my phone missing. So I don't think you're wrong. And this is what I mean. I feel some of this needs to be tweaked a little. Like, I don't feel those buttons and panels should be right justified. I feel they should be centered so that when text is in that bubble, there's like a clearer indication, or like scrolling back and forth, not just in one direction, ticker display style, that button hovers exactly in the correct location for it to be framed properly. That ended up sounding like just Star Trek gobbledygook techno speak. Like, I don't know how to express that any better. But no, I grok that. I mean, if we're taking apart UI design to that level, and we're looking at things like moving to larger target bubbles, I kind of agree. I think they feel off, but I don't think they're somehow radically less functional just because there are fewer buttons to kind of assault the eyeball with. That's a different complaint. UI density is a different complaint than what I think they're trying to accomplish with this new material design. You know what? I'm so way far behind on the chat. Yeah, and Trey, this is definitely something that needs to be addressed and tweaked. Correction, the only thing that gives me any pause on the Pixel 6 is the battery life. So we can chat my battery life experiences. There is a surprisingly good modem and radio performance. But my early concerns with the Pixel 6, as the battery life actually has improved over my week of use, especially mostly keeping my SIM card in the Pixel 6. See, this is difficult for me to kind of properly get a handle on, because it's been in the Pixel 6. I threw it into the Xperia for a bit. Then it went into the Duo 2. And I traded between the Pixel 6 and the Duo 2 because right now I'm only rocking one personal sim. I should have fired up my Google Fi and just done a month and gone that way. But for some reason in my head, it's like, when I need to use this phone, I need to use it as my phone. And having a second phone line with everything else that was going on was just too much. So I don't believe my early usage is in any way indicative of someone who buys and owns that one phone. But in my early usage, the actual performance and use during the day seems to have gotten better. And I can regularly make it to the end of an evening on a fairly moderate day, which for me is at least two or three runs on Dead Cells, a couple hours of high-quality music streaming, a lot of Bluetooth, a lot of Wi-Fi, some heavy 5G as I'm taking walks and using the camera with some heavy camera use. A moderate day for me is pretty full. I mean, it's not hardcore video rendering all day during the day, but it's a full day. And I can regularly make it to the end of the night, 30% left on the battery. And with my kind of use, and I use it a lot screen off, I'm rocking 5 to 6 hours of screen on time. If I were to tone that down just a bit, this would easily be a two-day run phone for me. Going a couple nights, one of the things that's bothering me is this is not currently a good phone for standby use. This is not a good phone for standby battery drain. So I put the phone out overnight. I don't charge my phones overnight. I charge my phones when I need to charge my phones. And even though the Pixel 6 is kind of a slow charger, I can reasonably get a day's worth of use if I can just pad 10 to 15 minutes plugged in. So, you know, again, I'm not letting the battery kind of cycle all night. I'm only trying to juice that battery when it needs it. So over the last two nights, as I've let it sit overnight, and it's connected to Wi-Fi, so, you know, we should be at the lowest power data connection, this thing will hit 10% power drain overnight. That's real bad. You know, I'm only getting like 5 to 6 hours of sleep over these last couple nights. So just letting it go, like putting it down on my bedside table, going 7 hours off the charger with no use and turning it over. So it's not even really firing up like the display for notifications and stuff. Almost 10% power drain is pretty bad. So that to me is the biggie. Like if there's something that needs to be addressed on the Pixel 6, obviously we're going to see UI polish. Obviously we're going to see app optimization improve. Obviously we're going to see Google really try to refine what this thing can do. Something's going on with radios and usage. And I wonder if it's not to maximize Samsung's 5G radio and, you know, their Wi-Fi stack and their Bluetooth stack, if it's like they've just got to run those components harder. They just got to run those radios harder. That to me becomes one of the fair criticisms, because you don't want your phone to just nuke itself when you're not doing anything, when you're not really using it. And also Gormlord brings this up too. It is a bummer that it doesn't have video out. I would really like video output, especially on a phone called a Pro. Again, Google calls it a Pro. I want it to be a Mi Pro, not a consumer just spend more on it Pro. And being able to plug a phone into a display is really handy for pros. I've got to scroll. I'm sorry. There are so many really great comments in here. Dr. Claw, it won't be.
everyone's going to hold up the Pixel and say, it's the stock Android. Dr. Claw writes, I hope this is the end of Pixel equal stock Android discourse. Pixel hasn't been stock for years now. We know this. We started seeing heavier customizations with Pixel 3. And we saw UI elements that were not a part of Android, I think, starting with the Pixel 3. And ever since then, that's been Google's flavor of what an Android phone should look like. That's not been stock. And the Pixel 6 is, whoa, man, not stock. I feel like this is clear, but we've got so many techies just so confuzzled about, but it's the Google phone. It's the stock. So yeah, it's pretty bad. So McCorkorin 3, I mean, six of one, half a dozen of another, writes, are they criticizing the Pixel or are they criticizing Android 12? And genuinely, like right now, it's got to be both. The only other examples of Android 12 are in betas. And if we're going to say, you know, reviewing a phone in beta isn't fair, then yeah, the only public-facing examples of Android 12 are currently on Pixels. So again, if you care about software updates, right? I mean, where is Samsung? Where are these Android 12? One UI 4, where is it? I mean, I've been using it on my Pixel 3a for a while now. I need that on a Samsung Galaxy A50. Where is the Samsung Galaxy A50 Android 12 update? How could Samsung be so bad at software? They have a promise and a commitment to their customers. They are not keeping up with support. You know, if you bought an S10e and you spent good money on this phone, it does not have Android 12. Average consumers are ripping their hair out right now as we speak, picking up their Galaxy S10s and vomiting all over the phones. True story, because that's what we care about. We're going to go just as hard on Samsung as we would go on Google, right? Because we're objective reviewers. We don't have preferences and biases. We're objective. I'm just keeping it a buck. That's what I'm doing. Yeah. I got like actually kind of worked up there. It was fun. McCorkorin 3. They have to explain away the price differential as well. The S21 FE is going to look so silly compared to the Pixel 6. And who feels like Samsung kind of sat on the FE after we really got more news on Pixel 6 and we saw some of the leaks on that pricing? Like, oh, yeah, hey, just making the phone a worse version of an S21 and charging a little less probably ain't gonna do it for us this year. Bespoke Z Flip. That's what we wanted to talk about. Yeah. Oh, we're Samsung. I feel like that pricing kind of wrecked a lot of reviewers out there, which is why we're seeing this pivot towards the kinds of criticisms that we're seeing today. I think a lot of reviewers were already, again, how many times have we seen, I said this in my Duo 2 review, a new phone is announced and reviewers go out of their way to say things like, I don't even need to use the phone. I'm just going to copy and paste my review from last year. And they've got all these people like backpatting about how they're not really going to use the phone. I mean, believe them. Believe those reviewers who say things like that, because they're saying the quiet parts out loud, but that's really what they're doing. They're not genuinely trying to figure out what these devices can do. So I feel like a lot of reviewers had already written a Pixel 6 review saying, you know, Google has some interesting things to offer and some, you know, there's a bit of excitement about this new SoC, but they're too expensive. Only Samsung is allowed to charge more in Android land, even though Galaxy S21 sales are down 40% over S10.
even though the market is speaking outrageously loud that there is a huge problem with premium Android phones, and Samsung is not getting that job done, getting people excited to spend more money on phones. But only Samsung can ever be allowed to release a more expensive phone, because that helps our search traffic. And then we make more money saying things like, Google's are too expensive. But then Pixel 6 dropped. Wow, that really screws up your pre-planned review strategy if a part of that was going to be too expensive, because now you've got a completely different animal on your hands. That's pretty rough. Steve, unusable, it belongs in the trash. Yeah, the Pixel 6 isn't that. I have the Pixel 6 Pro. The Pixel 6 Pro isn't as big as I thought it was going to be, but the Pixel 6 is, you know, just that hair, that little bit sort of shorter. It is what it is. I'm sorry, I'm catching up on the chat. This is terrible podcasting because you guys are cracking me up right now. Streamy Boys goes crazy on tech specs, yet only focuses on cameras, point and shoot capabilities. Do we want to talk about Pixel 6 camera for just a second? Because if you've been following rational and well-informed tech reviewers, there's been a conversation bubbling about Pixel and this new camera sensor. I'm going to toot my own horn because I came out with a video talking about camera upgrades. And when we increase sensor size, it's not a universal everything gets better. You've got to retrain algorithms. There are certain aspects of consumer-y point-and-shoot photography that get way better, like low light and indoor lighting. A larger sensor helps tremendously. I can't tell you how unbelievably responsive the Pixel 6 camera is when I'm in my living room shooting a photo of Lex in super dim conditions. Like, she's lit by a lamp and a TV that's wall-mounted feet above her, and it snaps the instant I touch that shutter button. That is the most performative average consumer point-and-shoot camera I've ever handled. It's faster than the Vivo in those kinds of situations. There's none of the Samsung shutter lag, and there's none of that OnePlus reframing, where it pauses and then kind of captures a later frame than what you actually pushed for the shutter button moment. It's incredible. And it is, you end up with a better photo than you ever would have gotten out of a Pixel 5, Pixel 5a. Though that's an improvement. But there's always a compromise when we mess around with the physics of lens design, sensor design, and camera software. And Google has to retrain all of their algorithms on this new sensor. So from the Pixel 3 to the Pixel 5a, we've got a ton of data on that 1 over 2.55 inch sensor. If you've been following anyway, so I want to hold up, like, people like Tech Tablets, TK Bay, the crew that, like, all of the Easy Computer Solutions crew, Barry Johnson, people that kind of appreciate that changing something doesn't always mean it's magically better. Apple is going through this right now. The newer sensors on these iPhones don't perform as consistently as iPhones up to the iPhone 12 Pro, especially iPhone XS to iPhone 12 Pro. That was a couple of years where Apple was using the same kind of camera sensor as Samsung's and LG's. Like, we understand that 1 over 2.55 inch sensor really well, and it is a wonderful balance of consumer point-and-shoot performance and size, so it doesn't take up a ton of space inside the phone body. Those sensors rock. And you don't need to feel bad if you're still, like, on a Pixel 5a. In most of the lighting conditions you would shoot on, you're still getting incredible photography performance out of that sensor. We know how to get amazing results. We've been using it since the Galaxy S7. This sensor is wonderfully well understood. The Samsung GN1 is a better sensor. We don't know what the heck to do with it. We really don't. We're figuring this out in real time. And when I compare and contrast results like my Vivo X70 versus the Pixel 6 Pro, I mean, we're in the Wild West. It's exciting for me because all of the aspects of photography that improve because of larger sensors are beautifully on display. Shallower depth of field, a much more dynamic range, and natively much more dynamic range. And then you add all the software tricks. I mean, what you can pull out of these photos is stunning. And of course, better low light performance. But they're not as sure-footed. And we shouldn't be surprised by that. iPhones aren't as sure-footed as they used to be. Samsungs are definitely not as sure-footed as they used to be with their nano-cell sensors. And this is the same. This is the same for Pixels. This is the same for Vivo. This is the same. We're on the bleeding edge of these newer camera sensors, and they need to be refined. And who do we think is going to do the best job of refining this sensor with successive software updates? Do we think it's going to be Vivo? Do we think it's going to be OnePlus? Do we think it's going to be BBK phones? Do we think it's going to be Samsung and their penchant for over-sharpening, unicorn puke vibrance, and weird contrast? Or do we think it's going to be Google? I think it's going to be Google, especially for what Google says they care about, and they care about the cleanest point-and-shoot experience. They've even gotten rid of, like, different flavors of auto HDR. Like, they're not even pretending anymore. The phone is an HDR shooter. That's what you get. You know, like, if you want as simplified and as streamlined, get to the point, get the good photo, and get it up to social media, it's Google. Even Apple's camera app has gotten way more cluttered than what Google is accomplishing in delivering many of the same kinds of settings. So, again, I hear, like, there was this, it was another Twitter space, and it was someone sitting there. It's just so, like, you know, I'm even comparing it against the Pixel 4, and the Pixel 4 is beating it. And you're like, in what way? I'm so tired of these, like, hack camera conversations. Winner, loser. I looked at three whole photos, and the Pixel 4 is beating it. Beating it in subject acquisition? Is it beating it in object tracking? Is it beating it in metering? Is it beating it in white balance accuracy considering the subject, or white balance accuracy considering the lighting of your scene? Is it beating it in depth of field, the quality and the aesthetic of the bokeh, which is a very subjective kind of measurement? Is it beating it in image clarity? Is it beating it in HDR post-processing performance? Because that's another sticky bit on the Pixel. You still see photos have to be manipulated in the background of the phone. The phone is working harder after you take the picture because it's still processing all that data. Beating it means zilch. It means eggshell. It's something that you get to feel real good that you gave the Pixel 6 some tough talk. But you got to back that up. Like, show your work. What is it beating? How is it beating? How is a Pixel 4 beating the Pixel 6? Pixel 4 is definitely not beating it in video. The ability to extract images out of darker and darker conditions, Pixel 4 is definitely not beating it there. The autofocus is on par, which is incredible. Actually, I need to make a bigger point out of that. So when you pick up a Pixel 4, you've got that 1 over 2.55 inch sensor with incredible dual pixel autofocus. It is a snappy snick. And then it locks on your subject and it does not let go. Google has the best subject tracking I've ever seen. Sony has the best subject identification and autofocus I've ever seen. Google, once you get it to lock, it does not let go. And you can even switch some of the camera modes. And it says, well, you wanted to focus on this dog. I'm going to keep focusing on this dog. It's beautiful. when you go to a pixel binning sensor, we've had a lot of problems with autofocus. You can look at the Samsung Ultras. That's great examples of, we've got way more pixels, we don't have as accurate photo sites for autofocus in those pixels. And then the GN1 comes around and it gets us really close. It gets us right in line with the kind of autofocus performance we had on the Pixel 4. That's a substantial accomplishment for this new kind of pixel binning sensor. That needs to be celebrated a bit more. So, short story, incredibly long. There are very few areas that I can demonstrate that, you know, Google has really fallen down on camera performance. I wish we had some more controls or the ability to lock settings. And, you know, if you wanted to adjust the white balance, it's changed every time you refocus. I mean, there are some things like that that I'm definitely going to be cranky about because I am a bit more of a pro shooter. For what Google is trying to accomplish, I don't have, or especially for the claims that they make, I don't have any serious worries. And I have every confidence that it'll get better than where we are at launch. It's already really good.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Hey there, Juan, and hey there, you. This is Jason Howell from All About Android over at the twit.tv podcast network. Juan has been a guest on All About Android a number of times. In fact, we have awesome guests on the show each and every week, and we'd love for you to check out the show if you haven't already. twit.tv/AAA is where you can go to find new episodes of All About Android. Each and every week, we talk about the top Android news, hardware, apps. We have a reviews portion called The Arena. It's very competitive, but in a fun way. We have a really great time doing this show, and we would love for you to join us sometime and check it out. We get journalists from throughout the Android world joining us. We even sometimes get Googlers who are actually making Android on the show to talk about what we love so much about the world of Android. That's twit.tv/AAA for new episodes of All About Android each and every Tuesday. All right, Juan, back to you.
I'm going to skip down just all the way. I'm going to go all the way to the current part of the chat. I'm so sorry. Again, fantastic conversations happening in the chat there. I'm so sorry. Juan, for your mental health, please take some time away from Twitter Spaces. The thing that drives me crazy is the only reason I do this stuff is because I'm into the conversation. I probably wouldn't be on YouTube if I, years ago, before I joined YouTube, I had an idea of creating my own smartphone forum, kind of like XDA, or for me, it was kind of like Dave's iPack, if you remember iPacks back in the day. I really wanted a community place like that. And for me, nothing matters but the conversation. And I even purposely in my reviews will omit things from some videos to talk about them in other videos, but the whole idea is to try and generate a conversation down in the comments. That's it. If I don't get, you know, my itch scratched by having a fun, geeky chat about something, then I don't make videos. That's all there is. And when you have like this new vibe of old school community forum conversation, Twitter Spaces, Clubhouse, as an audio nerd, I am all for this. But just like on Reddit and just like in so many other places, it seems like the swing happens really, really quickly where, you know, if we're highlighting one topic, that format becomes a way to slam that topic. On Reddit, you see it a lot. Like, there's a device-specific subreddit. Like, hey, I'm going to make a subreddit all for LG phones. And a lot of work has to go into fulfilling the conversations on LG phones. Else, that subreddit just becomes a place to hate on LG phones.
It takes so much moderation and so much active guidance to keep the topic alive before it just becomes sort of a toxic cesspool of people who hate that topic. And that to me is the tricky thing. Like, as we're seeing the tech community sort of join these new formats and these new forums and these new conversations, we're kind of immediately dumping all of the toxic aspects of this, and we lose sight of like actually using and discussing the tech. Now, for most of the people in that last Twitter Spaces I was in, only a couple of us had Pixel 6s, but so many people were speaking about the Pixel 6 with such certainty, and then saying, "Oh, but I don't have the phone, so I guess if someone likes the phone, then that's cool that they like it, but I know it's not for me." And you're like, see, that's not how we have reasonable and learned tech conversations. We don't go running into this saying, "I don't own this product, but let me tell you why it's bad." You know, I've test driven BMWs. I'm not going to be able to out BMW a BMW owner. You're like, "Oh, you've had this 328i for 10 years. Well, I once took a BMW 325 for a test drive. And let me tell you why, you know, it's not a good car." Like, I would deservedly be laughed out of the conversation. And I should expect to be mocked ruthlessly for trying to contribute to a conversation that way. I'm not saying we need more gatekeepers, but I feel there needs to be an understanding of, you know, where is this commentary coming from? How is it being expressed, and what are we really trying to accomplish in these kind of group dynamics? Oh, dude, Steve, yeah. So, Steve, the Pixel 4 might outperform the 6 in badly composited shot of a fire hydrant. You know, when you take the phone out to your front porch and you need a good photo sample, so you take a photo of a fire hydrant, man, the Pixel 4 got it beat. I took a shot, a terribly composed shot of a fire hydrant with the Pixel 4, and I took an even worse composed shot with the Pixel 6. And let me tell you, Pixel 6 camera is hot garbage right now. It's just so not good. Just beat it. Simon says, "Hypno, again, if we want to kind of steer, I've been talking for over an hour just with my gripes about the reviews, the drama. This is what happens when I don't have a clear-cut plan for my podcast is, boy, we just go off on some of these cranky tangents. So, you know, sitting in front of me, if you have questions or we want to focus the conversation on specific devices, like I said, right now I am full bore on Pixel 6 Pro, Xperia Pro I, Vivo X70 Pro Plus, and the Surface Duo 2. So Simon says, "Hypno, objectively, which of the Vivo, Xperia Pro I, Pixel 6, and 6 Pro feels best in the hand? Primates need to know." So, in terms of engineering and construction, I'm going to take this question legit because you know how I always make fun of, does it feel really nice in the hand? In terms of engineering, there's something about the Pixel 6 which reminds me so much of the OnePlus 7 Pro. And I think in part, my brain is going back to the Almond OnePlus 7 Pro. And there's just something about how the glass kind of goes into these metal edges that I just kind of dig. From an engineering and construction standpoint, out of all of them, I kind of like the Pixel 6 the best. From a practicality and a usability standpoint, the Vivo and the Pixel 6 are terrifying phones to use out in public. If you go to the Google Pixel subreddit, there are already 4 or 5 posts from people that have, you know, a minor drop with their Pixel 6 the first couple days that they've owned the phone and just destroyed the back glass, cracked into the screen. Brandon, this is Tech Today, already cracked his Pixel 6 Pro. Curved screens are scary. They're even scarier when you shoot with the camera aggressively like I do. I'm climbing rocks, and there's like a little hill, a little cliffside over by my house, and I'm over the edge, and I'm trying to get good shots with this phone, and there is such a tiny edge for your fingers. And I've been hiking, so I'm all sweaty and I'm all gross, and it's bright sunshine, and I'm trying to operate things on the phone, and I'm trying to hold on to the phone, and I'm looking over the side, and if I take one more step, I'm gonna fall like 30 feet. This phone is terrifying to use in a situation like that. I'm triple checking every single time I put it on a mount, because if it takes a slide, there is no angle this phone can fall where it's not gonna ripple crack the front or the the front or the back glass. I mean, you just assume anything like that is going to be like instant DOA. So they look really pretty. And if you want to put a Vivo in like a little display case on a Lazy Susan that rotates to show just like how impressive this engineering is, great. It's beautiful. I think the Pixel 6 looks a little bit better. But in terms of actually going out, you pick up a Sony and it's flat sides with ribbing. These are ribbed flat sides that your fingers just and stick to. And I'm trying to do like one-handed, you know, selfie shots. Man, so easy. NVIDIA broadcast is gonna mess this up. Holding the phone, three fingers, because there's a nice wide part of this space that three fingers just grip the phone. I can get my pinky finger right on that camera shutter, on that dual stage shutter, hold it out at arm's length, kind of angle it, and there's enough reflective material in the lens that I can actually see my framing in the lens, and I should say in the lens protection casing, ease into that shot from my pinky finger and bring it back. And holding it one-handed, shooting blind, out in the middle of challenging hikes and conditions, I feel so much more comfortable handling the Sony than I do any of these fancy looking curved glass, you know, OnePlus 9 Pro, even to a degree, like my LG Wing has a curve to the glass on that outer top display. Freaks me out. This kind of stuff is silly. I mean, I make fun of, oh, it feels really nice in the hand, but Pixel 6 is a companion device. I can maybe give that a pass. It looks really pretty. You can show it off. It's going to kind of turn some eyes. If people don't know what a Pixel is, they might ask you about it. The Vivo, I feel, should have flat sides. The X70 Pro Plus is a camera-heavy phone, and it is scary to use in those kinds of challenging conditions. The Xperia Pro I is the most pro phone for imaging you can use, and it's built to be a camera first. And that is so immediately apparent when you go and take it out and you start shooting with it that you can hold the phone. It's kind of refreshing. It's more refreshing than it should be. Oh, hey, I missed TK jumped into the chat. Everyone say hey to TK. Everyone already has said hey to TK. I'm the one that's way behind. Oh, Fat Produce. Not true at all. Everyone, I need backpats and lots of love for Andrew Fat Produce. Juan, I hate to break it to you, but I am a toxic cesspool. You are one of the kindest men I think I have ever met in my entire life. Andrew, we all know better than that. from Slick Rick, Sam Apple must design their camera sensors specifically for fire hydrants, hence the cult following of big tubers. There's probably an AI mode, you know, good smartphone reviewer fire hydrant mode. You don't even have to mess with it. It's just part of Bixby now. Bixby automatically identifies. You're going to follow me? There we go. Ooh, Kyle Ruggles watched 30 Days a Night. That's a great Halloween film. 30 Days of Night, I saw it in theaters with a good buddy of mine. And I had to watch that movie on my own after it came to home video because the movie theater experience was awful. It was kind of a half capacity theater. And what I love about that movie is it's so quiet. It earns a lot of the tension that builds up because there are so many set pieces of characters having to be quiet. And I love movies that play with that, but they're terrible to watch in movie theaters now. And so sitting like three rows ahead of us were a group of people that would get so into talking to each other and playing with their phones that they would miss the jump scare, or they would miss the payoff of all of that quiet tension. Oh, what happened? What'd he do? Oh, he just tore that guy's arm off. Oh, what happened? And like, you know, we complained to the movie theater management. They didn't send anyone in. They didn't try and hush anyone up. We got free tickets to go see another movie, but it's like, I'm never going back to that theater because the movie theater experience with that audience was awful. And so I watched it again, like a year later, on a rental. It is so good. I really needed that movie. I really needed that vampire experience in the theater, but it's so tough now when a movie really does need quiet tension. It's so hard to get that out of an audience these days. Oh, yeah, Kyle Ruggles. For the OnePlus 7 Pro, I missed the telescoping selfie camera. Remember how everyone was so concerned that that was going to be like a failure point for the phone? And it seems to have done fine. I know mine hasn't been taken out as aggressively over the last year, but like, it was working pretty well the last time I used it. From Jacob, I hate curved glass on screens so far back as to the Nokia 830. And again, like even that 2.5D sort of just edging, because what was it? Galaxy S7 was miserable for getting screen protectors because it wasn't a curved screen. It wasn't like an edge, but it just had just a taper. And you're like, oh, you can't stick anything to that. It's so frustrating. For McCorkorin 3, one would assume a good case can solve most of these problems. I got a two-piece clear case for $14 and it feels great. So it's not getting solved by the Google bumper, which is predominantly what I'm using the Pixel 6 in during my review, but I'm going to get another case for this. And I'm seriously looking at the Moment case because I want to get that bayonet camera adapter. This newer, larger sensor is going to be challenging to use with those clip-on lenses from other phones. I think someone needs to come up and start redesigning those accessory lenses for larger sensors. But the case that comes with the Vivo is even scarier because it is just one of these, like, it protects the back of the phone, but then the entire side is scooped out for the edges of the display. So there is not only zero protection, you could conceivably crack the back glass if it landed at kind of a funky angle. That's how little protection. I mean, I'm glad they put something in the box so you've got a bit more texture and grip to hold it. There is no side protection on the Vivo case. So scary. Yeah, I mean, at this point, I'm not even that concerned about the aesthetics. What does it look like? Oh, does it look really nice? Who could use it? It's such an old and boring design, said a guy who loves iPhones that have all had the same design since the iPhone 4. The conversation is increasingly irrelevant because you should be putting something on it anyway, even a skin, just to give it a better grip or better texture. But I like starting off with a better base. And if you're really into using a camera, then the Sony design being so hard and flat-edged starts you off with that better base. I like Apple returning to flat sides. You know, iPhones now have these kinds of flat sides. I think it's more practical. It's a more practical place to start. And then when you put a case on this, you still have that flatter, wider surface area for your fingers to really hold on to this
and not interact or accidentally hit things on the screen. Dustin Dory ribbed, giggled like a 12-year-old. And yeah, I mean, curved screens are annoying, but everyone gives Samsung a pass when they put it on the S21 Ultra. Oh yeah, the LG Wing has a big curved screen, but no notch or punch hole. It is beautiful. Curved screens, a day in the life. Me, hey honey, check out this hilarious YouTube video. Promptly, what video? Why are you showing me the home screen? It's so funny, those kinds of interactions, because I had to talk about that on the Duo 2. So the Duo 2 is very, very broad, but when you hold it in two hands and you're typing with two thumbs on the single screen use, it's like having a BlackBerry Passport. It's this broad keyboard with these big keys, and it's easy to use. And when I pick up, maybe a little bit more on the Vivo than on the Pixel, because of the curves, I have to crane my thumbs to like the folding points. Like I have to pull my thumbs in, or I've got to open my fingers out to type on a curved display, especially like when you're hitting those edge letters right into the curve. And that's also where the phone screen is the least accurate. It's where it's the least sensitive. So again, a little bit more on the Vivo than on the Pixel. Like I mistype more because I'm having to pull in, and maybe I'm typing fast and I don't want to like flatten my thumbs to the edge, to their closest. And I have a bit of arthritis thanks to all my psoriasis. Like that's not comfy. I don't like that. So you'd hold it in one hand and you try and swipe type instead. And that's good for some things. It's not good for others. And then you pick up a really broad, flat phone like the Duo, and you're like, oh, there's so much room for activities. I can use like the full span of my hands, and I don't have to cradle the gadget in a funny way. Oh, so refreshing, because it's different. Yeah, Kyle Ruggles, I absolutely loved that interpretation of vampires. Again, I'm always going to be down for a vampire story where the vampire is not trying to seduce its food. I don't know, like, the last time you really had, like, a romantic affection for your meal. But for me, I love vampires as apex predators more than I like vampires as, like, angsty, lovelorn, ancient beings that always seem to fall in love with starry-eyed teenagers. To me, that's kind of gross. In much the same way that we would look at like a full-grown person, like, you know, trying to seduce a junior high student. I have some issues with the lustier depictions of vampires. I might have to save that for a different podcast before I get myself into bigger trouble. Oh, Slick Rick, that's beautiful. I love to hear that. A Quiet Place was truly a once-in-a-lifetime experience for me. Packed crowd, everyone shut their traps. I even felt heavy guilt upending my horrendously too loud bag of candy. For me, it was the first Paranormal Activity where I was real anxious. I'm sitting in the theater, and people are talking, and there's a whole bunch of activity. The woman next to me, she's this rail thin woman, and she is like, she's got the biggest tub of popcorn, and she's horse troughing it, and it's like she's open mouth maw chewing, and like kernels are like falling back out of her mouth and back into the bucket just so that she can kind of like re-scoop the partially masticated bits of popcorn. It is so much more disgusting than I can properly convey sitting next to her. And we get into the second night, and the movie is already building enough tension with this audience that she puts a half full bucket of popcorn under her seat and rolls up under her sweater. And she spent the whole rest of the movie
just eyeballs peeking through the sweater. And I could not have loved a movie more in that moment for shutting her up. It was so amazing. If you ever watch Paranormal Activity today, the movie completely fails. But if you ever got to see Paranormal Activity in a large group of people who wanted to get lit up with jump scares and shut up during that movie to allow the suspension of disbelief bubble to survive, they're not making jokes about how stupid the people are. They're sitting and watching the movie. That movie was amazing. You watch it today and you distract yourself for even an instant, or you make one joke to let off the tension, Paranormal Activity is like one of the worst. I mean, like, it's terrible. You can't watch it with friends because you're always going to have that one jerk friend who, as soon as they start feeling the tension of every night, they're going to let off the tension by making a joke. And Paranormal Activity is a soap bubble. The suspension of disbelief is that fragile. And if you lightly blow, make the wrong noise in the middle of Paranormal Activity, it's not going to be scary anymore. Marie and I did watch Dune. We had a good time with Dune. It is long, but one of the things that I think is really impressive about Dune is the scale of everything in that film. It's one of the few sci-fi movies of late where they go to great lengths to impress upon you when something is big. This is such a silly, small thing to, like, praise in a movie that's beautifully constructed, is wonderfully adapted. I think the cast is phenomenal. Like, not enough good things that I can say about Dune. I really liked it. And it's slow, quiet, fantasy, sci-fi. It builds to its moments. It pays off moments well. We get to a conclusion of the film where there's been an arc. We've seen a character actually grow through their experiences. Like, this is good storytelling. But very, very early on, as they're introducing the different planets that action will take place on, there are just a couple of these moments where they showcase, like, a spaceship. And they give you a kind of an almost Battlestar Galactica sense of the scale. So not only is space enormous, but this thing that people built is also really big. And the gravity of those kinds of moments help define this world. It helps seat this world in some kind of weird space opera fantasy practicality. But I liked it a lot. I really liked Dune. I'm way behind on the chat again because I talk too much. Oh, Gormlord, I love the duo screen. I love the duo screen. I'd take a Microsoft Uno. Yeah, a Microsoft Solo would be fun too. But again, I mean, if you have a Microsoft tablet, you kind of already have like a Surface Go, a Surface Pro. I mean, for as much as I want there to be like a standalone smaller Surface, we kind of already have those. We just need to improve like Android app compatibility, and then it's not really going to matter. Shots fired at Twilight. Okay, so it's not just Twilight. Obviously, Twilight is one of the ones that I'm more clearly identifying because there's that whole like trend of like, you know, middle-aged women that got real invested in Team Edward, or I can't remember the other character's name, but yeah, there were. It's kind of icky, right? You know, I would feel grossed out about some dude my age getting real thirsty about a high school girl. I kind of feel it's fair to get a little icked out by women my age getting real thirsty for a high school boy. I can't remember the other team. That I'm so glad that elements of Twilight are finally evaporating from my memory capacity. There is a grand tradition of Victorian-era vampires that are lusty. Victorian-era vampirism is definitely an era of fiction and of history where we used the metaphor of corruption and blood we used those metaphors to describe, you know, sort of adult themes and situations. But I still feel that a lot of that is more based in a concept of vampirism as corruption and of the outsider that takes you from your home group. There were, you know, big fears, like you would live in this small village or this tiny community, and an attractive outsider might come into your activity and whisk you away, and you would never know what became of your family, or you would lose the connection to your roots or to your family or to your heritage or to your history. And I think vampirism in that era becomes a cautionary tale against that kind of manipulation or corruption. It's Victorian lusty is now charming, right? Because we live in an era where you can look up anything on the internet that you might want to watch. But for that era of storytelling, when we get into Bram Stoker's Dracula, it's more satisfying because it's still a darker, corruptive force, not an ancient being that genuinely falls in love with a younger potential food source. What happens in Dracula is awful and terrible and dark, and because it's awful and terrible and dark, we can use it to kind of be a little enticing and titillating, and ooh, that's getting the vapors up. That's a far cry different than when we arrive at modern day vampirism, where vampires eat people, but then also fall in love with people genuinely. I mean, with like the full conviction of an affection or romantic entanglement. And I have a hard time with that. You know, this is a being that's potentially immortal and feeds on this population of life forms. And at the same time can also like fall in love with them for the moment that they're alive, knowing that they'll die sooner. Again, so I just feel like the modern incarnation of vampirism, when it looks like that, is missing the point of why Victorian era storytelling was lusty and titillating. And they're trying to do something in that same vein. Like if you want a really good, if you like 30 Days of Night and you're in for a long book, I can't remember who wrote it. It's The Historian, is kind of a tale, an adventure tale of some people trying to track down a Dracula figure. And it leans heavy into Bram Stoker's Dracula, but it's a more modern-day adventure story. And there were some genuinely unsettling moments in that book. It is a long, quiet read. And the payoffs for some of these settings, like, you know, you make those jokes, like, you're kind of reading through your fingertips. I'm holding this book and going, oh no. And it's beautiful, but it took like 400 pages to get to that moment. The book just kind of builds and builds and builds into those types of moments. And I love, you know, vampires that are corruptors. I love vampires that are metaphors for other types of influence and manipulation. And I love vampires that really do lean into almost cosmic horror, you know, the unsettling aspects of like a Lovecraftian kind of story. And if you like that kind of stuff, and you're patient, and you like letting horror kind of build on you, I really liked The Historian. Elizabeth Kostova. Simon Says Hypno says Elizabeth Kostova, and that sounds correct to me. So I'm going to go with that. I really like that book. Oh, man. I'm falling so far behind. DTNL, horror movies are a hard pass for me. Scariest movie I've watched is Terminator 1. Terminator 1 is a great horror flick. It's humans trying to survive an unstoppable force. I mean, it's robo sci-fi horror, but it's still horror. That's genuinely a brilliant horror film.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
Yeah, Vazicos. Correct. Absolutely correct. So Vazico says, I saw paranormal activity in the dark on my phone. A Samsung Omnia HD headphones are a must for that movie. Okay. We're talking movies. I know Halloween was yesterday, but you know, technically we could kind of play a little with this. Dia de los Muertos is also coming up. So, I mean, we can still talk about El Spookies, or Los Spookies, I should say. Genuinely, when a movie depends on a very sensitive or very fragile suspension of disbelief, the absolute best way to watch a horror movie, Juan Bagnell, trademark, patented, copyright, 2021, citation given, it's right here. Best way to watch it, get the best medium-sized screen you have. If that's a big phone, if that's a reasonably sized tablet, if it's a smaller laptop, that's what you're going to watch this on, all right? So you take that screen and you black out your entire living room, bedroom, whatever space that you want to be in. In my opinion, the bigger the space, the better the experience. Down to the fact where it might be the best way to watch a horror film if you're sitting at the end of a long hallway for the extra depth, and you're gonna black out that entire space. No lights, none at all. You need it to be as dark. You're familiar with your home. You're familiar with your surroundings. You need it to be as dark as you can possibly make it. You also gotta wait until there are zero distractions. So in my opinion, get until like 2, 3 a.m. and you're kind of tired, maybe you've had a day, you're fatigued, but like you're into watching a movie, that's the right time to do it. And then you get the best headphones you can get. And you make sure they're plugged in or connected on Bluetooth, whatever, you know, but you need killer amazeballs audio. Now, why do all this? If you have a great TV, you could just watch the horror film from your great TV. I think a lot of us have gotten into bad habits where if I'm watching a movie, there's every instinct to occasionally pick up my phone and distract myself from what I'm watching across my living room. Also, a big TV can light up your living room enough that you're able to really get a good bead on what's in your living room, right? The darkness around you is not all-encompassing. It's well lit because your TV is actually putting out enough light to kind of side illuminate everything around you. So if you're watching the movie and you look away, you can still see that you're safe. And then also you're probably not listening on headphones unless you're a nerd like me and you've got Bluetooth adapters connected to your TV so that you can put on headphones. You're going off of speakers. So you also have the sort of situational awareness. Like maybe your air conditioner kicks on or your dishwasher's running. There are other life things happening in your home. The refrigerator kicks on. So all of those are just those little elements that help inform, hey, you're still safe. You're still in your living room. Everything's fine. But if you go to a smaller screen that cannot light up everything around you and you're tasked with kind of holding on to that screen so you can't as easily pick up another phone to distract yourself with. We go to where the light is. The light is safe. The darkness is scary. The darkness is potential danger. But if we're watching a horror movie, we're looking at the scary. And if we try to take our eyes off of that horror film, our eyes are looking at blackout conditions all around us. And we can't see what's happening down that hallway. We can't see what's happening in our living room. Our headphones are preventing us from hearing the life that's happening in our homes, even when everyone else is asleep. So you can look out into the scary, inky black darkness before your eyes can adjust and give you your night vision back. Or you go back to the light source where all the scary stuff is happening. You have no good out. You have no good option to let the pressure off of a scary movie. Absolutely, a number one. If you want to watch a movie like Rec or Paranormal Activity, the original Blair Witch, or any of these movies that reward you for investing your attention and building up that anxiety and building up that tension and kind of ratcheting you into the scary, a tablet and some headphones is chef's kiss. That is horror. You have not experienced horror until you have given yourself the horror experience. And that is so hard to do when you can distract yourself or let the pressure off. If you're not going to let the movie really work you up, then you really haven't lived it. You really haven't like tasted how crazy that angsty feeling can get. The wraparound shot in Rec, sort of the middle nights of Paranormal Activity as they start building and building. The Ring, I think, is a very good example of every day in The Ring builds more tension than the day before. The movie's not scary, but it's working you up over that entire time. Those types of experiences are golden. Mwah, just beautiful. I love it. Sorry, getting me to talk about horror films is kind of hilarious. Yeah, Slick Rick Moranis, absolutely. The romantically predatory vampire only work if a movie actually portrayed it as awful as it actually would be in real life. Some of the Hammer films I think are pretty good at that too. If you're talking classic horror, they're cornball, but I still think they work. I have a harder time kind of thinking of like what vampires really got me kind of worked up in a more modern storytelling context. Love the burger, not the cow. I mean, that should be a vampire motto right there. I'm going to write a script about vampires, and that line is going in, and I may or may not credit you, Ted. And Slick Rick Moranis, I realized recently that my iPad Mini 2 is the perfect size to read books. As someone who missed out on so many books except for H.G. Wells, last night I downloaded a whole lot of books and I'm getting to work reading them. It's so nice when you find those types of solutions for a good piece of tech. Again, like as I open up my Duo 2 and my daughter immediately goes, oh, can you read comic books on that? And I went, yeah, you can. It was pretty great. Let me scroll this down. Yeah, Simon says Hypno. Terminator 1 has the inevitability of zombies. You know they are going to get you eventually. It's so good. It really is. from Tiger Cam. Yeah, I'm good on all that. I would have to burn down the house if I did all that. But I'm telling you, if you dig on horror, that is the way to do it. I love it. Night of the Lepus is terrifying. All right. Oh, The Grudge was also solid. Again, I kind of just snapped first. You know, like another film that I think would kind of work for that, again, quiet and building and eerie, is Let the Right One In.
That's when I ended up watching that movie at least like once a year. And again, vampires as a corruption force. Oh, it's such a beautifully tragic film. And again, it's formatted in a way where a lot of the action that takes place is just so well earned. Like, they set up these set pieces so well that the payoffs are just brutal. It's just so good. So this is an interesting question. Wouldn't you say that if you need to take so many extra steps to enjoy a horror movie, that just means that those movies are not scary enough? Like, if the movie relies on something, on setting up the atmosphere for a jump scare you already know is coming and it fails, that's kind of on the movie, no? You know, if this were the 1970s, I'd say sure. But right now, we're watching movies in our homes, so there are all these lifestyle elements that distract us from watching the movie. You don't have the same conditions in many situations that you have. Even if you have like a really nice home theater setup, you're still in your home. And one of the things about going out to a movie is you are not on your home turf. And ideally, you should be around a whole bunch of strangers that social convention would say you don't want to upset. You don't want to distract them. You don't want them to distract you. So everyone's on their best behavior. But one of the things that really works against horror films is watching them at home and watching them with friends. Because, like I said, inevitably, you've got the one friend who's going to turn everything into an MST3K ripoff. And he's not that funny. He's not. Stop hanging out with that friend, right? He's doing you dirty when it comes to watching horror and really experiencing horror. So what I'm talking about is creating the conditions to enjoy a horror film to its utmost. And to create those conditions, you have to make your home unfamiliar territory. And so I don't think it's like, well, it's the fault of the movie if it doesn't make me put my phone down. Why doesn't the movie just make me put my phone down? If the movie were good enough, I would just watch the movie. But we're not really programmed like that anymore, are we? Right, I was watching Dune, thought Dune was amazing. 3/4 of the way through the film, for no good reason, I picked up my Pixel 6. Like, it was like a learned response. Like, oh, I haven't checked my Twitter in an hour and a half. I better see what's happening. And it was a conscious effort for me to go like, no, I'm watching this movie and I like this movie. I'm going to put my phone down. You know, I wouldn't do that in a movie theater, because in a movie theater, I'd be worried about pissing off people around me with the light of my phone cranking on. So this is why we need to take those efforts and we need to make those considerations to fully appreciate what's going on. I suppose it could work for other films, but I don't feel like, you know, a wacky screwball comedy needs the kind of investment and focus for moments to pay off. Like, if you watch a movie like It Follows and you're only kind of casually invested, you miss incredible setups like 1980s Kids in Peril, Goonies style setups that take time to invest. Old school like slasher film kinds of build up moments that then pay off with an evil scary monster. Like, if you don't focus and you don't give the movie your attention, or you let off the tension for just a second, you can't get back to the same place. And that's not the movie's fault, because you're actively ebbing off the energy and the attention and the focus. And that's not on the movie. That's on the consumer behavior for how they might interact with media in the comfort and the safety of their own living room. Like a tense thriller kind of deserves that. A really good action film can deserve that. I don't know that a screwball comedy really benefits as much from the same style of like hyper-focus when the payoffs are a little bit more momentary. But that shared communal experience is incredibly difficult to replicate when people feel safe to distract themselves from the film. And again, I can't watch horror films with friends. Because again, they just want to turn it into a yuck fest because they're all uncomfortable. And that's the point, is for me, is going into a horror film like, let's see how much this film can really ratchet me up. And that's not fun if someone's like, why would you go into that room? You should just run out of the house. Am I right? High five, guys. Let me get some more popcorn. And you're like, you know what? this isn't fun. I don't enjoy this. So Simon Says Hypno, I agree for the most part. Simon Says Hypno writes, I hate jump scares. They just seem lazy. A good jump moment can be satisfying in the roller coaster ride of how a film is working up the anticipation of a payoff. I think the original Halloween, John Carpenter, is really good at those moments where there's a fake out, but then that immediately leads the audience into understanding, like, oh no, something worse is coming. And I think under the work of like a really savvy storyteller, a jump scare can be phenomenally effective. But I think especially to your comment, and to the tone of your comment, I think they're grossly overused. And instead of a character gasping, and then we see that it wasn't anything serious, now jump scares have these annoying like music stabs. There's like a shutter to the camera work. There's like a quick pan or a whip or a zoom in or something like to like really try and scare you. And those are hack. There's one moment, Donald Pleasance in one of the Halloween films, like the sheriff walks up to him and all he does is, and if you're watching the movie, like you gasp with him and then you see it's the sheriff and everything's fine. That's a jump scare. That's a good earned payoff for a moment happening in the movie that the audience is with that character and you gasp with that gasp. Beautiful. Other than that, if you have to like, you know, do a whole bunch of song and dance, jump, sound design, stabs, sound effects, and music, then it's probably not worth the jump scare. Otaku. Haha, joke's on you. I have like 3 friends and I haven't met with any of them in years. Oh, I feel that too. Oh, Slick Rick, I'm bad about this also. Like, I think I might have ruined Evil Dead 2 for my wife. I talk too much for the wrong reason, too much enthusiasm about the movie. Same. I'm real dangerous about that too. Gormlord, The Witch is awesome. It is such a good movie. The Witch, there was like a whole grouping of quieter horror films on my list this year that I didn't get to. Absentia is really good. Midsommar is phenomenal. What is it? Something, The Pretty Things That Live in the House. I really liked how eerie that was. Hereditary is like 1970s schlock polished to a modern sheen. Some really good ways. Really, really good movies. Yeah, Dusted Orion. The original Halloween is so good for how it was shot and its production value. It's the perfect example of low-budget filmmaking by people who love what they are doing. Absolutely agree. Oh, no. From Jaime, one of my kids was wrecked by Sarah Jessica Parker popping up from under the covers in Hocus Pocus. Oh, you poor kids. Oh man, we're to the end of 2 hours and we have talked very little about phones. So I appreciate you all coming with me on this ride. I've been so like up to my eyeballs in all of these devices. I'll save like sort of more of the future commentary for some of these. For some of my future videos. Sorry, I got one more from Slick Rick here. I'm easily distracted talking about horror films. From Slick Rick, one sort of horror movie that cannot be ruined by a talking group of friends is 1977's House. Nothing can explain away that movie or make your friends' jokes less insane than that movie is itself. It was Kappa Cash. You were saying it's a pajama podcast. This is definitely a PJ podcast vibe.
So, yeah, I've got a video set for tomorrow, for Wednesday. I might take Thursday off, and then Friday getting back into kind of some of these longer wrap up videos. I'm spending just an extra minute to polish up my script for the Pixel 6. And one of the things I'm going to be cutting is a lot of my cranky ranting, like how we kind of started the first 45 minutes of this podcast. I don't want the drama over tech reviewing to overshadow the Pixel in the same way that I kind of feel like my Duo 2 video is more about how to review the Duo 2 than it is really sharing my thoughts on the Duo 2. So now I feel like I've got to make another follow-up video to the Duo 2 just to share a bit more, like, this is actually how I'm using it, not just what I've found while trying to review it. And I've got to follow this up. So I'm also considering, like we said before on Best of Our Week last Thursday, I need to shoot some very specific samples with the Vivo, the Sony, and the Pixel 6. Not because I feel there's an easy way to declare a winner. If I do a camera comparison between those three phones, if I go Vivo, Sony, and Pixel 6, there isn't a winner. These are very, very different kinds of photography experiences. And if someone genuinely came up to me and said, like, well, hey, what would you recommend for a good camera phone? I can't imagine the individual I would be speaking to who I would genuinely recommend all three of these phones to that one person. That person would have to give me a lot more information on their shooting style. And from there, I'd be able to guide and say, maybe you need to go iPhone, maybe you need to go Samsung, maybe you need one of these three. Maybe you would prefer a OnePlus 9 Pro. So I've got to take some time showing that. Like, showing my work on that is actually a lot harder because the nuts and bolts, there are going to be a lot of similarities on things like depth of field blur. So that, as a photography concept, is kind of where all of these phones meet in the middle. But how you use each of these phones is phenomenally different. And I think that's the thing we do the worst job of in tech reviewing, is we get so focused on these camera comparisons, but we're not really leaning into the strengths of each phone. We're instead saying, like, this is how I composed the shot for an iPhone, and then I had another phone side by side, and I just pushed the shutter button on that other phone. And wouldn't you know it, my attention for framing on the iPhone arrived at a better shot than the other phone that was just sort of on the same stick side by side. So I'm trying to wrap my brain around how to do that in a video that isn't just me, again, reviewing reviewers. I want to review the phones, but I also need to make it clear, like, you would not consider these three phones if you really had a specific idea of what kind of camera you wanted. So anyway, there's a lot for me to kind of work my brain around. That might not end up landing this week. I still need to finish shooting some samples. I'm going to maybe put out a call on the Patreon, whether or not I should try to do the camera deep dive on the Pixel and on the Duo before we get heavier software updates. There's supposedly going to be a pretty sizable December patch coming for the Pixel 6. Do I put all the effort into making the Pixel 6 camera review now, knowing that it's not going to be as accurate in a month? And that kind of stuff hurts my brain. Like, I'd always be waiting. I'd never get any videos done if I didn't eventually just say, okay, we're going here, we're going now. So that's kind of where we're at. That's the state of the union for some Gadget Guy videos and reviews. But, you know, I guess, like, maybe have some patience and some compassion for tech reviewers out there that seem genuinely
wiped out by Techtober. But then also maybe look for those folks that are just having the most fun that they've had in a while. When I turn on some of my friends' channels, when I see like some of the really fun commentary that's being produced, when I'm not just seeing shrug and sigh after shrug and sigh, and people are picking up these genuinely different devices that have very specific things to offer, and they're making different kinds of claims. This is the most fun I've had in years. This to me is now improving and rivaling like 2018 and 2019, where we had a healthier flavor of competition for a bunch of our phones out there. And it's kind of wiping away just how drab I felt 2020 was for a lot of phone reviewing. This is kind of perking me up a bit. And we have some more brutal competition and some more fun things to do. Vazicos is saying, wait on the Pixel. I really feel like if I go just one more camera update, then we can really start digging into what makes this Pixel different from others. So I think that's kind of the direction I'm leaning, but we'll have to see. Like the Vivo just got another pretty sizable update. And one of the things they're showing is like, they're saying that they've improved video stability. And that was kind of a twitchier bit in my Vivo review. I like, maybe I should have waited on the Vivo. I don't think I should have, but I don't know. I don't know. Anyway, folks, we're going to go ahead and cap it here before my voice totally fails. I'm going to take a drink of water, and then we'll blitz through the ending. Yeah, Aditya Nil, hashtag some perked up by Techtober guy. I'm feeling exhausted and refreshed at the same time. Genuinely, like, I have never been cutting videos and putting stuff out fast. Last Monday, Pixel 6 embargo went up, so TK and I had a joint video on Pixel 6. I did the podcast. The podcast failed, so I had to re-edit the separate video bits into a new file just so that I could upload the audio version of that show. The Sony was that night, and I had a reviews.org video that I had to upload that day. That was Monday. Monday was the longest month of my life. And so this Monday, I'm like, hey, I kind of don't know what to do with myself because I am not on deadline for 5 different products to put out in one day. So now it's all just the fun. It's not just get the phone, review it the first week that you have it, never talk about it ever again, tell everybody why they shouldn't buy it and they should only buy Sam Apple, and then move on. Now is where we actually start using all these things. And the community of people out there, you know, TK Bay, Tech Tablets, Lisa over at Mobile Tech Review, brilliant commentary on some of these gadgets. I mean, again, an impressively consistent reviewer who is so articulate at sharing her thoughts and feelings on different devices. If you're not watching Lisa's videos, you're bad at tech, genuinely. Tech Tablets has been rocking my socks lately just for mobility, and some of his coverage on the new MacBooks, beautiful. I mean, genuinely wonderful stuff. Find those creators out there that are digging this, because right now we've got hot options and they're flipping fun. So on that note, thank you so much for jumping in, joining this rambling diatribe of a podcast, this ridiculous conversation. This chat made me so happy. I'm just seeing everybody, all these names and familiar faces in the chat. Just genuinely great stuff. And to wrap all this up, I hope you had some fun family moments or you did something fun for yourself for Halloween. We're coming into the holiday season, and obviously that can be really stressful for a lot of people. There's the buying season and the Black Friday stuff and the Thanksgiving and the Christmases and the Hanukkahs and the Kwanzas and getting into all of the end of the year activities. And this is going to be more stressful than in years past. There's a lot going on in the world right now, and I think we need to be looking out for each other, and I think we need to have each other's backs. And one way to do that is also to kind of show the fun. So don't be too worked up on, you know, oh, I need those tough criticisms all the time. It's
there's genuinely some fun out there if you're looking for it. So thank you so much. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. And I'll catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SDGQA podcast channel. Be safe. Take care. I love you all. Catch you back.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.